So with that, let's pray, and we're in chapter 19, or concluding chapter 19. Lord, we do thank you for this chance to be together, and thank you for your word, thank you for the Bible, and thank you for all these Wednesday nights, just years of this. Years to review, to read, to cover, to learn, to glean, to be reminded. That's one of the great things about this. It's nice to have questions answered, and I suppose so many of the times as we're just reading your word, even tonight there's a couple of odd sections of this, or odd for us because it doesn't quite compute the way we think it should, but it's nice to have more questions answered, and it's nice to be reminded. That's really the thing. Nice to be reminded of what it is you've already declared in your word, and what you've done for us, and how you want us to be, and the blessing of the history of those who have walked before us. Of course, thinking about the 30th anniversary, what a joy that'll be as we think about your faithfulness, your goodness to us. And think about Paul and Cindy and the kids all those years ago, 3 decades ago, moving out to this part of the country to start something brand new. Thank you for that. And again, here just reading through, studying through the Old Testament, examples of your faithfulness and examples of other people who followed you. It's important. So we're grateful for Wednesday nights. Grateful for tonight. Would you bless our time further? We're blessed by the fellowship. Would you continue to bless that, Lord? And for those that need your touch, there's a lot of people in the fellowship that could use your physical touch, physical healing upon them. I ask that you would bring healing to my bride. Lord, even with the reports or whatever, the forecast of impending weather, keep everyone safe tonight too. May we have just a great night's sleep, and may our ground get the water that it needs, and not much more than that. So take care of us, Lord. And again, thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we are in verse 31 of chapter 19. Of course, I guess this has been a couple weeks ago now. Absalom, you know, with his uprising against the king as he tried to, and effectively did, usurp the throne, though it was a limited amount of time that that happened. Then, of course, he received the bad counsel, if you remember that in chapter 17, the bad counsel for him, for his cause, for Absalom's cause, but it was good counsel in terms of David. There was some espionage kind of thing there. Finally, it all comes to a head. And then Absalom dies, and so particularly in chapter 19 is kind of the, maybe not the aftermath, but kind of some reconciling of who's who and what needs to happen. So that gets us to verse 31. Now, Barzillai the Gileadite, he came down from Rogalim, and he went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan, as the king is now going to be heading home. So who's this guy, Barzillai? We find him in chapter 17, actually, the very end of the chapter. In fact, verse 27, if you'd like to just take a second and turn the pages to that. 2 Samuel 17, verse 27. Now it happened when David had come to Mahanaim, that Shobi, the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the people of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel from Lodibar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, they brought beds and basins, earthen vessels and wheat, barley and flour, parched grain and beans, lentils and parched seeds, and then verse 29, honey and curds, sheep and cheese of the herd for David and the people who were with him for them to eat. And they said, this is their thought process, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. So this guy, Barzillai, he kind of took it upon himself and with these other individuals to make sure that David and his company were in good shape. So after everything happens, back here to our text, verse 32. Now, Barzillai was a very aged man. Is that a nice way to say it? How old are you? Very aged. And it tells us, 80 years old, very aged. And he had provided the king with supplies. I didn't write it. It's there. And he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, come across with me, and I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. So David, recognizing the generosity of this man, kind of wants to repay him, wants to bless him. And I love this, but, verse 34, But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? And I am today 80 years old. I don't know if that means it's his birthday that day, or I happen to be 80. Can I discern between the good and the bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? This guy's just kind of resigned. I'm an old guy, you know. Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Verse 36, your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? I love that. And we'll keep reading. Just see this man's heart. And then he says in verse 37, please let your servant turn back again that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant Chimham, and let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. And the king answered, Chimham will cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do for you. Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king had crossed over, or when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. It's fun to read these kinds of just individual conversations that David has with these individuals along the way. But I love this guy, and I love this because there's so many examples that you can find in them, and so many examples of how to be. And sometimes this is one of the things that we love about the Bible. It gives us examples of how not to be. But this is not one of these guys. This is someone that we can definitely learn from his example in a good way. He just seems to be the kind of guy that was happy to serve, was not in it for the blessing. They're at the end of chapter 7, like, they're hungry, and I'm rich, so why would we not, hey guys, let's get together, you know, Machir and these guys, let's get together and let's just help the king. We have the resources, let's provide that. And then here, at this point, as David's saying, look man, can I please just repay you? Like, I don't need it. I'm old, right? I've only got so much, I can't even tell the sound of singing anymore. Just let me go back to where my father's buried and my mother. I'm content. He's not in it for the blessing. And this is really the evidence of it. He blessed David when things were at their worst for David. Right? Like, this guy is not in a position that I'm definitely going to get some return on this. There's no guarantee that David's going to be again in a position to be able to bless me. While he is at his lowest point, I will try to take care of him. This is this kind of true loyalty and true faith. It's true commitment. Truly happy to be a blessing, whether or not, once again, I know repetition reinforces, that's why I'm continuing with this, whether or not David and his company, his family, would ever be able to repay him. This is a gracious, others first servanthood that is on display. And I love this because here's this servant, Chimham, and it's, well, David, actually, if you're so bent on blessing, here, bless my servant instead. Just have him go with you and bless him. Just bless him. I'm fine. I don't need anything. And then, of course, from here, as David is now crossing back over the Jordan, everything just goes back to normal, right? Now we're back to the place of goodness in the land. Verse 40, the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, and you wonder what their tone is. We're not sure, but I don't think it's polite. Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan? How come they got to do that? We didn't get to do it. So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, all the other tribes, because the king is a close relative of ours. I wonder if, like, that's why that's what happened. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he ever given us any gift? Like, what are exactly, you're accusing us of what exactly? What exactly do you think is the issue here? In what way do you think that we've, I don't know, made money off of this? Benefited from this? Received some kind of rewards that none of you have received? Why would you think that? And verse 43, all the men of Israel answered the men of Judah to this, you know, obviously this one tribe, and said, we have 10 shares in the king. Therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Like, there's more of us, so he's more our king than your king, single individual tribe. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back, notice how they say it, our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel, or harsher, maybe your translation says. Again, not surprisingly, and we'll see this as we move into the next chapter or two, time permitting, even when the right king is on the throne, there's still issues. Still issues. And I wonder what it was like for David in the midst of all that arguing. Like, just standing there listening to it? Does he try to stop it? We're not told. I think interesting for our Christian lives, you get saved and you imagine now life's going to go great and now I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to be complete. I'm never going to sin again. I'm just everything. And we're all laughing. It's like, yeah, how about that for thought? And all my problems are basically just going to just vanish, right? They're going to go away. This is just going to be so great. And then like, and the next day, like, man, what's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you. You have the right king on the throne of your heart, and yet there's still issues. Yeah, welcome to the club. Welcome to the family. This is how sanctification works. Christianity is not really for the, I don't know, for the weak, or it is for the weak, that he might be strong on our behalf. So chapter 20, now things are going to be great, right? And there happened to be there a rebel whose name was Sheba, or Sheba is fine, but Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So, verse 2, every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to their king. Welcome home, David. And I think there's a little bit of a hint there as to what's happening in verse 1. This man, Sheba, of his father is Bichri. He is a what? Benjamite. Yeah, he's a rebel, but he's a Benjamite. Does that sound familiar, important? Who was the first king? Very good. And he was a Benjamite. So I wonder if there's this thought, I'm not going to bow to that king, and look how he takes care of his household. No way. So what we have, I'm laughing because this is crazy. Like, he returns back to across the Jordan. He's now in Jerusalem, and immediately, well, we have 10 shares in the king. He's our guy. And come on, tribe of Judah, we know that you're from the same tribe as the king, but come on, you guys are like maybe just pulling from the top here because you're so close. And like, okay, well, he's definitely our king. And almost, I don't know how much time passes from verse 43 of chapter 19 until verse 1 of chapter 20, but it starts with, "And there happened to be there a rebel." Almost, is it 5 minutes later? Is it 5 days later? Whatever. Like, the very next thing, David, welcome home. Let's get away from David, the son of Jesse. Man, there is this rebellion against, of course it's David, but more specifically, this is a rebellion against the Lord's anointed. Also, you have to ask this question, and we'll come back to it in a little bit because the answer is maybe not as simple as we think. How fickle are the people? He's like, they're fighting here. The other tribes are fighting. He's our king. And then this guy, Sheba, he stands up. "We have no share in David, nor do we have any inheritance, the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, so Israel," so they all leave. More on this in a few moments because I think it's more than them just being apparently fickle. So we can kind of look through this a little bit, and we're going to spend an extra few minutes on this just because it just seems, it's unexpected. Like, David's return, so everything's going to be hunky-dory. But it's also not expected because why would I think everything's going to be hunky-dory at any point in my life, right? Why do we imagine as Christians that we're not going to face attacks of the enemy? So this rebellion happens. When David, surviving the Absalom incident, is weakened and he's vulnerable. Not shocking when that'll happen for us. The enemy likes to do that. By the way, the enemy also likes to attack when we're doing really well. We have those prideful moments, like we have some great victory, and like, yeah, I got it, doing great. And the enemy says, oh, perfect, you sure do. You're doing great. You don't even need to talk to the Lord. You're doing so great. And he allows us to be puffed up with pride. It's interesting how the enemy works. He's pretty good at what he does, unfortunately. There's three principles that are common to rebels and rebellions. Is, you know, you look at this, we don't know really much of anything about this guy. So, like, how does he do this? Or let me ask it this way. How does he sell this? And I think the ways, these kind of three things that he says here, there's like three basic statements there in verse 1. These, they prove to be common principles in rebels or rebellions. The first thing, of course, he says, we have no share in David. What he's doing, it's saying, this is all, and that's the important part too. Like, what does this man actually do? He speaks. And the power of words, especially in a vulnerable time in the history of the kingdom here, words have so much power. What was the thing that we all used to say when we were kids? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's just actually not true. Like, words might be the most hurtful thing there is, or there are. So he's denying David's place, denying David's authority. Essentially, if you kind of milk this a little bit, he's saying that David has no right to lead. We have no share in David. This man has no place, no authority. And again, he's speaking about the Lord's anointed. Notice the second thing, obviously, that he says here. And this is kind of a little bit of a cutting remark. Nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Why is that so cutting? He doesn't really mention David. He's the son of, he's mentioning Jesse, the son of Jesse. It's a slight against David's family. It's a slight against David's father, Jesse, who was kind of a nobody. His kid was a shepherd, you know, wasn't a whole lot to that family in that regard. He's devaluing David by devaluing David's family. He's devaluing David's background. He's labeling David, without even saying his name in that second statement, he's talking about David's family. He's just common. There's nothing so special about this guy. No, nothing so special about this son of Jesse, who there's nothing so special about that guy either. I wonder if everyone recognized that Sheba was, of course, a Benjamite. I wonder if he was happy to tell people that. I wonder if that lent itself to it. Saul was a Benjamite like me, and he was the first true king. But this guy David, I don't know about this guy. He's common. He's nobody. There's nothing special about him. And it would be crazy for us to follow this nobody from a nobody family. And then he says, the third thing he says, every man to his tent, so Israel. Which is a little bit odd, but this is what he does. And then the result of that little three-part statement, every man of Israel deserted David and followed this guy, Sheba. So every man to his tents, which means let's get out of here, of course. And it almost leans, it seems like it's leaning towards independence. Like, let's get away from him. Let's just go to your own tent and do your own thing. But definitely follow me. Like, you don't need to follow him, and just go do your own thing. But since you're doing your own thing, why don't we go ahead and just follow me? Because that's what they end up doing. And who is this guy? Again, not much is told us about him, but he is this self-appointed rebel against God's appointed, called, qualified, and anointed leader. Success. Everyone follows him and deserts David. Congratulations, rebel. Everyone, of course, except for the men of Judah, They're loyal to their king, we're told there in verse 2. The great tribe of kings, Judah. But why? Like, how is this happening? Why is this happening? And why do these kinds of things, and I can't help but to see it, but I'll tell you that like this is kind of what happens in churches. If you've been around the body of Christ for more than, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, like you see this kind of thing happen. And it's not, I don't think it's by accident, and I'm not smart enough to plan this, that we're in Romans chapter 12 and talking about, you know, the body and the unity and every part has a part to play, that kind of thing. But this happens a lot, and the way kind of church splits and whatnot happen is these kinds of statements are made, that the questioning of the person that the Lord put in place, the labeling them kind of common, they're a nobody, there's no value to this person, why would we want to follow them? So instead of following, let's just leave, and then let's follow this other person instead, who is a rebel. So no share in David, he's questioning his God-given authority. And there's no grounds for such questioning. He just says it. It's also super odd, and I'm obviously not smart enough to do this either, but in our political spectrum, in our political world, they're like, this person, fill in the blank, does this. Like, are there any grounds for that? Do you have anything to support those statements? Don't ask the good questions. I'm just making these statements. And they just make statements, you know. And this same kind of thing. The son of Jesse, questioning his background, which, of course, if you really examine David's life, his background, that kind of meager, nobody background, helped to define David and equip him and prepare him precisely for the role that God had called him to fill, to lead the kingdom. Just that shepherd boy. Do you remember when we talked about this way back, however many months ago in 1 Samuel, when David was sent on that mission by his father, before he left, he made sure that the sheep, like the actual physical sheep, right? Like someone was tending those ones, not the people, like, is someone please taking care of? And then, okay, Dad, I've got it. This is covered, and now I'll go take care of this task that you sent me to accomplish. And all these things, again, help to define, equip, prepare him to actually lead the people. So Sheba is saying, here's why you should not follow David, and then really says nothing. It's just, and does this sound familiar? It's just empty slander. And apparently because they follow him, they desert David, verse 2, and they follow Sheba, the son of Bichri, his idea of them following him, but he offers them no reasonable, no credible reason or otherwise to actually follow him. It's almost just a good couple of propaganda types of statements. And everyone just kind of sinks their teeth into it. And they get, well, that guy made a good couple of statements, and don't ask the good questions. Let's go. It's like the power of persuasive words, the power of persuasive phrases, the power of slander, and the power of, well, this person must be someone because he's also a Benjamite and the first kings from there, so therefore he must be someone important. That's scary. The power of assumption without anyone asking any, like, wait, hold on a second. Thanks, Shabbat. Maybe this is a good idea, but can we just ask a couple questions? Because David actually seems to be pretty amazing, and his family turned out to be pretty great, and people aren't very good at asking questions, though. To be a new pastor of an existing church, you know, we're in our 11th year here, and man, you discover how this works. And I love verse 2. Because there's always this faithful group that sticks it out, that says, no, I don't know about that. I don't know about that, Sheba. I don't know if that's something we're going to want to do. And I can smile because, and God is ever faithful throughout the whole thing. So here's David. Welcome back to Jerusalem. And here's another battle for the great king. And by the way, I highlighted this a couple moments ago, and I kind of asked the question. It would seem that these people are so fickle, right? Because at the end of chapter 19, no, he's definitely our king. And then a few verses from that, they're completely disloyal to him. And it seems like they weren't really, of course, loyal at all at the end of chapter 19. They were pretty much just doing what? They were honoring themselves. We have more part in the king than do you, tribe of Judah. He's more our king than your king. We're more related in that sense than you are. They're not even so much as fickle. They're just prideful. And pride lends itself to this as well. Brings us to verse 3. Now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, who he had left to keep the house when they left, when Absalom kind of made his way into the kingdom, or into the palace, and he put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. I mean, this stinks. There's just no way around this. These were the women who were raped by Absalom, and in a word, they're what? Victims. But they're now victims further because none of this was their fault. And so David seems like deciding what to do with them. There's no grounds for divorce here. They weren't unfaithful, as if David had any room to talk about, you know, that. But they were also defiled by his own son. So there's no further place with him and with them for any kind of intimacy. But because it's the relationship to the king, so it's almost like on one hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, there's no room to find men for them to marry. That would have created itself yet another set of challenges within the kingdom and challenges to the throne. And ultimately, as you look at this, obviously David should have just brought them in his initial exile. Why did you leave anyone? Well, you need to take care of the house. For what? It's odd, but this should be painfully obvious as well. Much more, he never should have had so many women in his life. Like, maybe just start there. And here's the statement about this whole thing. In verse 3, it's brutal for a lot of reasons. But sin has horrible effects on others. That's what this is. They are victims, and they're victims in a bunch of different directions. And now, notice the end of the verse. And now for the rest of their lives, they're living in widowhood? As widows? Check my math there, but that means as though their husband's dead? Well, he's not. But the relationship's dead, but you're not really free to go pursue anything else. It's really pretty tragic. Verse 4 tells us, and the king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Verse 5, so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. Of course, quick question, who is this guy Amasa or Amasa? If you remember from chapter 19 and verse 13, David said to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also. If you are not commander of the army before me continually or forever in the place of Joab. Congratulations, dude, you're taking his job. So all this is transpiring with Sheba, the Benjamite, the son of Bichri, and David first takes care of these concubines, and then, hey, Amasa, this is what I need you to do. In 3 days, we got to get this thing rolling. David understood that time was of the essence, but there in verse 5, and it tells us, right in the middle of the verse, but he delayed longer than the set time which was appointed to him. So David understands time is of the essence, but this new leader, Amasa, is slow. Does he not understand the urgency? Does he not care? Is he not really in it for David? Is this just a way for him to kind of work his way into some greater position of power? And maybe here's a simple question too. Is he not the right man for the job? And like that seems tough to ask just on like in 3 days we need to have this happen, and he's not able to do it. But he had been leading whose army right before this? Absalom's. And what happened to Absalom's army? And this dude's leading it? I mean, they got, it was curtains for them, right? And so now David, look, we're relatives or, you know, same tribe or whatever. So you're going to be my guy. You're going to take over for Joab. And the first major task he has, like, he just can't get it together. David apparently gets tired of waiting. And I'll be careful how you think of this. Gets tired of waiting. And what's your immediate thought to that? Well, you just got to be patient. Is that how we think of things like, man, I'm just tired of waiting? Our initial thought, well, you just have to be patient. Not everything is a you just have to be patient kind of a scenario. This is a time for swift action. I mean, back it up, just in the thought process, no doubt, of David. How did David manage to defeat Absalom? By working out a way for his friend to get into the council and say, no, we need to not act swiftly. The wise counsel would have been, we need to go right now and take out David while he's weak. And guess what? That would have worked for Absalom. But instead, it was Hushai and Ahithophel. And the worst counsel is brought as a means of kind of swinging the situation in David's favor. And David understood that if Absalom had worked swiftly, it'd be curtains for us. So David knows we need to move quickly. Verse 6, and then David said to Abishai, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do more harm than Absalom, or do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. So Joab's men with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men went out after him, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. So off they go. David just, yeah, this is, I'm tired of waiting. Amasa's not really doing the job, so hey guys, just go make it happen. Off they go, verse 8. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor, and on it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, the sword fell out of the sheath. Then Joab said to Amasa, are you in health, my brother? And you wonder what his tone was there. I don't really wonder. I'm assuming, but it seems super friendly, no doubt. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. This is a normal greeting. And, you know, just kind of, you just kind of grab someone by the face. Hey, just that kind of like tender kind of approach. But, oops, verse 10. Amasa didn't notice the sword that was in. So, even that, not the greatest military guy. Like, I just didn't see the sword at all that was in Joab's hand. And he struck him with it in the stomach. And here's your happy thought for Wednesday night. And his entrails, notice the word, this is the New King James, poured. His entrails poured out on the ground. And he didn't strike him again. Thus he died, or he died from his that wound. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Classic Joab. This is Joab doing Joab things. He apparently did not believe Amasa was worthy of David's mercy. This is the guy that just led the army of Absalom. Absalom who just tried to take over the kingdom. And actually for however long, successfully did so. And you've got his guy that's taken my job? I don't know that he's worth the mercy you're providing him, let alone the promotion that you're giving him. And this would be kind of the same thing that happened with Abner. Or perhaps that. Do you remember? In fact, would you just do this? Turn back to chapter 3 for a moment. Hold your place here in chapter 20. Like, this is eerily similar. Chapter 3 of 2 Samuel. Pick it up in verse 20. Abner, who had been kind of leading Ishbosheth at that time. In verse 20, so Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Verse 22, at that moment the servants of David and Joab came from a raid, and they brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. So kind of they just missed each other. Verse 23, when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab came to the king and said, and I wonder what the tone was here. He seems like the kind of guy that was free with his opinions. What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he's already gone? Surely, and there's not even like an O king here. Surely you realize that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. And verse 26, and when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David didn't know it. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. And a few chapters or so later, same, same. Interesting there in verse 25 in chapter 3, what Joab says, which indicates obviously what he's thinking. I mean, brain scientists here are, you know, genius to figure this out, but this is assumption. Surely, David, you realize that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you. That's the only reason he'd be here. He came to deceive you, to know you're going out, you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing. He's basically just this kind of a snake. That's so Joab's answer, I'm just going to kill him myself. Back here in chapter 20, I'm wondering if it's the same kind of assumptions about the former leader of Absalom's armies. And perhaps it really was simply anger or jealousy. Like, this is the dude that's taking my job. Hey, buddy. Oh, man, good to see you. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab. So if you're with David, you're with Joab. But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw, when they saw that, all the people stood still. It was just kind of this guy laying in the middle of the street. He moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him. When he saw that everyone who had come upon him had halted. When he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. There's no nice way to say this, but you kind of get the impression that he didn't die instantly. Like, the stab to the stomach is ultimately what killed him, but it probably wasn't instantaneous as he's wallowing there. And the men followed Joab. And Joab and these men, they would have known Joab, right? He has been their leader. He's been their guy. I hate to use movies as illustrations, which is why you almost never hear me do it. It's the great movie Gladiator, when they recognize, like, general, when the men hear that you're alive, the men will follow you. They don't care about Caesar. They will follow you. They will go after you. It's kind of that idea. And Joab really was just a true, what? Leader. Definitely, yeah, warrior is also the right answer. He's and a murderer, oh, by the way. Not great, but a great leader. And really interesting, again, I'm not smart enough to put this together, but Sunday, just there in Romans chapter 12, who has the gift of leading should do so with diligence. And Joab could be saying, no, I'm not doing this. David thinks he's going to fire me. I'm not going to do anything that. But he actually works. And he leads the people. And someone with the gift of leading needs to guide other people. And even the silly illustration I gave you about the little boy that, bringing the water to the front and falls. Sometimes the leader needs to just kind of stop everyone and say, okay, thank you that you want to buy 500 bottles of water to remedy this, but let's just not right at this moment. Yeah, but we need it. I understand that we need this, and thank you for wanting to give. But maybe, can we do that 10 minutes from now? 10 minutes after service might be a better time. Oh, okay. Or the person that has the gift of prophecy, like, Maybe not right this moment. I'm not saying what you're doing is wrong. I'm not saying it's incorrect. It's just maybe what we need right now is to get the service started. So maybe, like, yeah, let's get the water cleaned up and let's... And the person that has this kind of gift of leading just knows the proper place and the proper timing for all of the other gifts. It doesn't supersede the other gifts, but it kind of helps. And don't you need that? Don't we need that? Someone just to direct the gifts. And it's funny that we need that because, and again, how this works in Romans chapter 12, we all have our gifts. And just because of what we are, and that's why in chapter 12, verse 3, he starts the conversation with, don't think more highly than you ought to think. Then he talks about the body, and then he talks about the gifts. And even with that, well, I have a gift, and not that I'm prideful that I have a gift, but I've got this gift, and where we tend to think more highly of ourselves is, my gift that I have is probably the most important one. Well, I mean, I know it's not the most important one, but any situation or scenario, I've got my gift, I'm ready to go. There's an old pastor from England, Pastor Jim. He used to say, when people would ask, what's the most important gift? And his answer, and I'm paraphrasing, was the gift that's needed in the moment. Kid spills water. You know what's really not needed right there? Speaking in tongues. Like a just great gift. A wonderful gift. And an important one. But not really needed in that moment. And there's a lot of things that... And we tend to think, well, but my gift, I know it's not the most important, but I need to use it right now. Well, it might not be necessary right now, and it might not be necessary all the time. And leaders try to put the right people and the right gifts into the right places and to help people be prepared and equipped for when the time arises and to help put them in. And it's a tough job. At any rate, here's Joab. He's this true leader. Yes, also good answer. He's a warrior, and he's, oh, by the way, a murderer. So they're going after Sheba, thank you for the side note that you allowed me to have there. In verse 14, he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Makkah and all the Berites. And so they were gathered together and also went after him, or Sheba. And they came and they besieged him in Abel of Beth Makkah, and they cast up a siege mound against the city. And it stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab battered the walls to throw it down. So they find him. There's our rebel. And they get to work. Wisdom is now going to present its case through this wise woman. Verse 16, then a wise woman cried out from the city, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak with you." Is that guy here? Can I talk to him, please? And when he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he said, "I am." Then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I'm listening, go ahead." So she spoke, verse 18, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they will surely seek guidance at Abel." Like this city, this used to be the place that people would go for counsel. And they would end disputes. Kind of, this was the place for that. "And I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. And you, Joab, right, you seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" Great wise woman, and a great use of words to kind of put Joab into a place of thinking through what he's doing here. So Joab, verse 20, answered and said, far be it from me that I would swallow up or destroy. That is not so. But a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. Like, I don't really want to spend the time tearing down your walls and killing all of you inside. I'm not interested in that. So the woman said to Joab, "Well, okay, watch. His head will be thrown to you over the wall." I don't write this, right? Like, happy Wednesday night. I'll just, in a, give me a minute. Give me, and so we'll take care of this. So then the woman, in her wisdom, I love that, went to all the people. This is great. And they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Kind of, here you go. He blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. This is a mission accomplished at that moment. So the rebellion, effectively and fairly decidedly, squashed. And did you notice in verse 1, and I'm not sure if you have a different translation for this, and there happened to be there a rebel. If you're reading from the NIV, the New International Version, it'll say troublemaker. And that's actually a pretty good rendering of that. There's a few other translations, the ESV and others, that will say a worthless man. Maybe your translation says a vile man. Maybe it says a wicked man. Some translations would say he's a base fellow, or this kind of person is a base fellow. One translation renders it a man of worthlessness. If you're a King James person, any King James? Son of Belial. He's a son of Belial. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Exactly what all this says. Unprofitable, wicked, etc. And probably the best way to put this, he's a son of ruin. And what do sons of ruin bring? Ruin. I'm pausing on this because this is not the only time that this word is used. You have it in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Remember the sons of Eli? That NIV is accurate. Those dudes were troublemakers. And the translation for them is the sons of Eli, they were the sons of Belial. In chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, remember that guy Nabal, whose name means fool and he is acts according to his name? He was called there a son of Belial. And in 1 Samuel chapter 16, or maybe I guess it's actually 2 Samuel chapter 16. Check my notes on that. Yeah. 2 Samuel chapter 16, Shimei, that's going after David when he's leaving the city and throwing rocks at him and cursing and everything. He calls David a son of Belial. You're a troublemaker. You're a son of ruin, O son of Jesse, kind of thing. Those seeking to bring ruin. A rebel. Think of it in New Testament terms. What's the best parallel in terms... Actually, I'll give you 10 seconds to think about it. What would be the word that would probably be most accurate or paralleled to this? There's no sons of Belial in that phraseology in the New Testament, but who might that be, or how is that described? How about wolves? Wolves. Beware of wolves. What do wolves tend to do to sheep? Like ruin them by way of killing them. Wolves seek to harm, seek to separate, seek to pull sheep away from the shepherd. Rebels, sons of Belial, sons of ruin, wolves. Acts chapter 20, right? Wasn't this the Apostle Paul's great concern as he met with these, the last time he's meeting with the elders, the leaders of the church in Ephesus, there on the shore. He's about to board this ship. And they're going to have this loving embrace. One of the very last things he's saying to these leaders, they're going to go home to Ephesus and they're going to lead the people there in Ephesus. He says, but know this, after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Hey, leaders, this is what's going to happen. He says, from among you, such men will rise. Isn't that frightening? From among you, from your midst, these sons of Belial, these troublesome kind of people that are going to want to do harm. Remember years ago, another old pastor kind of putting in a couple different categories. There's sheep, there's wolves, and sometimes there's sheep with sharp teeth. And sometimes there's actually just wolves in your midst. And then what Paul continued there in Acts chapter 20, speaking to those Ephesian elders, he said, they are going to speak perverse things, or that can actually be translated misleading things. And they'll be speaking these misleading things in order to draw away the disciples after who? Themselves. What is Sheba, the son of Bichri, doing? David, that guy's a joke. He's from a nobody family. Just go to your own tents and, well, by that I mean you should follow me. This is 3 John, great little postcard of an epistle. John speaks about this man, Diotrephes. And you should read it. Spend some time in 3 John. There's only a few things said about this man, Diotrephes. It's just a few verses. But he spoke malicious words against John. Yeah, that John. John the Apostle. Like, if there's ever anyone in the New Testament you're going to speak words against, it would not be that guy. But this man, Diotrephes, spoke against John. And John told the people there that were receiving that little postcard from him that this man, Diotrephes, loves to have the preeminence. His warning? Watch out for that kind of guy. Paul's warning to the Ephesian elders, look out for the kind of person that's going to come in and he's going to be this kind of misleading person, drawing disciples away from the church unto himself and just have this own little following. These are wolves. Look out for that. This rebel, this man. Joab gets involved and it's put down, but what a mess. Let's just finish out the chapter. I've got notes for chapter 21, but we're not going to do that tonight. So Joab was over... This is funny. This is funny to me. Verse 23, Joab was over the army of Israel. Amasa, he didn't last long at his post, so Joab is still apparently in charge of that. Ben-Ia, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Adoram was in charge of revenue. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Shiva was scribe. Tzadok and Abiathar were the priests. And Ira, the Jairite, was a chief minister under David. And so, to answer your question, no, I have no idea how Joab kept his job, but he did. And maybe David just shrugged his shoulders and gave him whatever the handshake would have been, like, all right, thanks, man. Thanks for... I asked Amasa to take care of Sheba. He couldn't do it. And David will make sure that someone deals with Joab later. But for I don't know. He's not his enemy. What's the old... keep your friends close and your enemies closer. He's not his enemy, but it's like, yeah, I think probably at this point, Joab just needs to... I need to have some control over him, and him just being fired and being angry is probably not going to go in anyone's best interest. Interesting. Like, you want everything... do you feel this way whenever you read the Bible? You want everything to be, like, holy and good, and everyone's just a cookie-cutter kind of... everything's just right. How you doing? Praise the Lord, brother. There's no problem. There's no issues whatsoever, and everyone's just right. There's no rebels. There's no fighting. There's no people arguing about who's in charge. There's none of... there are 10 tribes. We have more. You want it to be just perfect, and then you read books like Job. And I guess where I'm really encouraged by it, like, you're encouraged by that? I am. When I read the Old Testament, it's such a mess. And you read the Gospels and the 12 apostles. I mean, oh, by the way, one of whom made a terrible career decision. Like those closest to the Lord did not get it right all that often. And the disciples proved that they were disciples by admitting, Jesus, when he taught the parables, we actually don't know what you mean by that. And that's what made them... they asked questions. Disciple means learner. They wanted to know. But so much of it is a mess. And I guess what I'm saying, why I'm encouraged by this, life's messy. It really just is. And so don't have this fanciful and wrong... this is wrong thinking to have this thought. Everything's supposed to be just right. Like, where do you get that? I can honestly say that where we probably get that... fairy tales, maybe. There's something inside of me that's prideful, that like, I can do, I'm better than that. And then I live my life and that proves apparently I'm not better than what I am. And I wonder how much is just satanic, devilish, demonic, that says, if your life's not perfect, it's because you're just doing a bunch of things wrong. You're not blessed because we look at you and look at the mess. Even the things that aren't your fault, that's God's way of saying, you deserve this. You deserve pain. You deserve difficult. And we become discouraged by that. I wonder if we would just say, maybe I'm just normal and maybe life is just really, really messy. Even again, when you have what? The right king on the throne, there are still rebellions. Still rebellions. Have a great night. Thanks for being here. Chapter 21 next week.